All right, Erin, welcome to Money Bites.
Yeah, thank you. Excited to chat with you on Money Bites.
Awesome. As we like to intro, Winnie is a platform and a community of women in tech looking to advance their career and money journey. So really excited to hear your journey in both fronts. Our resident for three questions. The first two, what would be a one-liner intro of yourself? And then the second would be, what would be a surprising trivia about yourself?
Cool. Oh God, I didn't come up with a clever one-liner. I would have asked ChatGPT for help there. But I think that, you know, I don't like the phrases like guru or expert or anything, but I'm just like, I just want to be a UX badass and help other people be badasses too.
Love it. So. That's a really cool one-liner.
I hope so. My improv class, bang up. No, and then like the, oh God, I have so many like trivia things. I actually have like a Google heap of them. So trying to mix them up. But one people find most interesting is I am a part-time beekeeper. I have two hives at my small house upstate. And so we have honey every year. And I don't know, it's great. I feel like you learn a lot from bees.
That's amazing. Are you doing it as a hobby for self-consumption or are you productionizing?
No, I think it's really important to have hobbies that are not on, you know, these things in front of us all day and use your hands. And so I got into it more as like a nature kind of thing and helping pollinators. It's actually really quite relaxing. And I did sell it for a minute, but I really did not enjoy the selling of it. I liked the packaging design and I loved giving it away. Unfortunately, I was in a place where financially I didn't really need to sell it. So giving it away was like a huge thing that I really enjoyed doing.
That's amazing. I am impressed that you have the courage to be so close to bees. But also, I absolutely plus one to doing something with your hands, doing something physical when so much of our lives is so connected to the digital.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I feel like gardening is the same. A lot of the people I work with or the folks I work with will do like knitting and crocheting. And I look, it's so lame. I was like, that's not lame at all. It's very cool. You're making things. Or like just like being a movie buff, you know, just something to try to like stimulate other parts of your brain, I think is super important. But bees are not scary. Wasps are horrible little things, but bees are fine.
I will try to keep that in mind the next time I come close to a bee. It seems a bit of a hacky culture was something innate in you from early on. Would love to transition that to your experience with starting in the arts. How did that
go? Yeah. Sorry, did you say hockey culture? Like hockey, the ice hockey?
Hacky, like hackathon.
Oh, hacky. Oh, yeah. I was like, I can tie it to ice hockey too, but we'll say that.
Oh, okay.
No. I'm sorry. Tie me back to your question again.
Starting in the arts, how did that come about?
It was actually quite funny. I was getting into a lot of like trouble in school and things like that. And my mom, I think, recognized that I needed a different kind of hobby. And so kind of forced me to volunteer at this art gallery / art center where they had a lot of classes where I would teach part-time. And I was actually really into darkroom photography, which I know is like kind of a lost art at this point. People still do it, which I love. But I was teaching darkroom photography or assistant teaching in that. So we're using the enlargers in the darkroom, talking about chemistry and like reeling film in the darkroom, that kind of stuff. From there, just started getting more and more opportunities. Finally got a paid job there. And eventually over the next like 5 years, I was like running the programs. I was running the summer camps, I was running the adult programs for all the classes, as well as curating the art, making sure we had like actual semi-famous judges come in. And so really learning that business as well as applying for grants. And so although that wasn't like a money-making venture, that was something that was kind of adding culture to the community, which is really important. And that like got us running this thing at like 18, 19 years old, which is quite terrifying. But from there, I needed to create ads. I needed to create flyers and brochures for the programs. And so I taught myself how to do it, a little pirated Photoshop thing back when that was a thing. Don't come for me. But taught myself Photoshop and in InDesign, actually, and started learning to do that, had a small mentor, and that's how I got noticed first for graphic design. And I feel like the arts beginning, though, is really important in having that kind of grounded cultural aspect to it and adding something to a community. And I also got a bunch of free art out of it, which is pretty nice, too.
Amazing. Okay. Wow. This is like killing multiple birds with one stone. Was this the time period, though, in your satisfaction graph when things take a bit of a dip with both the life and career satisfaction?
So all that happened prior to my chart actually beginning. I feel like, you know, I could extend that chart. So in my chart, you know, I was freelancing for a while, you know, in my 20s, just being rowdy. Was more like doing freelance work or graphic design work for local businesses in the area, like massage studios, bars, events, that kind of thing, which was fine. I was making enough money. I had a little apartment on 7th Avenue in Ybor City, which is like the party district. But I was doing all the graphic design for the building that I lived in. So they gave me a huge discount and loved that. The reason that my chart took a dip is I am old enough that I was working during the 2008 recession. And that was a time where even like little graphic design jobs, people weren't paying. It was actually more lucrative to like have a waitress or hostess job. And I definitely like respect those roles. But for the first time in my career, I had seen like, oh, it's actually more profitable for me to do that than to do the like graphic design job that I was used to. And so I had to really start to look outside. And I had a bunch of friends that were working at a call center in Brandon, Florida. And I think that, you know, going to work at a call center is not a bad thing. I think it taught me a ton. It taught me how I don't want to be a manager or how I wouldn't run a company. But the reason it took such a turn is that I wasn't necessarily set up for success in this call center. I think they were grading you on a lot of calls or listening in, but then like failing you for things on the call that were not necessarily your fault, or customers like wanted to talk or tell you their story and you want to empathize, but you have something called an AHT, an average handle time, where if it goes over 2 minutes, like you got to get them off the phone without being rude and hanging up on them. So it was like this impossible balance of things, and they've changed that thankfully now. But I think that was like a very interesting transition, and I'm not, you know, saying like I respect those roles so much. That's why I'm so kind to people on the phone now. But I think that was hard, you know, going from somewhere where I thought I had a high value skill and suddenly it wasn't valued anymore. And I had to learn a different skill, which was rough for me, but I think I got really dang good at it. But management wise, it was hard to be rewarded for that. But I will say the things that I learned in the call center, as far as like listening and empathizing, I still use to this day.
All experiences looking back, the dots connect.
Yeah, they certainly do.
Love it. So it took quite a bit of a dip, but then it also took a pretty sharp upward inflection. Is this when the agency work came in?
Yeah, so it's funny. Yeah, looking at the chart, and of course this is happening since what I put 2008 to today, so it looks pretty sharp, but I feel like it's a longer timeline.
Of course.
But yeah, so the good thing is, you know, the recessions eventually dissipate. I had all the skills, and I started working at a smaller agency and was applying for other kinds of agency roles. Didn't get this one job, which was fine, but they sent me a postcard to tell me that I didn't get the job after they basically told me I had the job. So that was like,
oh no,
really rough. Yeah, I know people get rejections now through email, which also sucks, but like imagine failure at a job and then you got a postcard. Anyway, so I'm still applying for work. And then the person that told me I had that job that sent said postcard, I ran into in a Best Buy like a year later. And I was like, that's how I know you. And I was like, I want to be nice, but I'm like really upset with you. It's like, and so I was like really kind to them. And then like a few months later, they hit me up and they're like, hey, I have a job that has a connection to Major League Baseball and this agency. Are you interested? And of course, I'm like trying to be cool, but inside I'm like, hell yeah, okay, yeah, let's go. So that got me in the door of like an agency. We were working with a lot of professional athletes. And it was like out of my house in Tampa at the time. And that started me moving into not just doing graphic design work, but also doing like a lot of web work and web development work, as well as strategy work as well, and learning how to manage clients, which was huge. And so I feel like that was the way I first started working for Webinize, essentially. And yeah, and like climbing the reins in that company and gaining a lot of trust and a lot of new client friends. Like actually one of them that played for the majors that lives in Raleigh now just hit me up recently to catch up. So it's like, it was a really great exposure. And I worked there for a long time.
What was the prompt that got you out of the call centers to going back into the creative field?
I think it's just always knowing that that's where I felt my skill set was. That's what I enjoyed. And so it was just a matter of just keeping at it. You know, I'm skipping over a couple of roles between the call center and the actual agency. Cause you know, you're just like, you're spitballing, you're just trying to like survive. And like, a, you know, not that it was like the worst recession, but it definitely impacts you. So I think it was just, I always knew I wanted to be back in there. I loved doing creative work. I was still doing it on the side. And I just, I don't know, as soon as I got that next role, I realized I needed to expand my skill set into doing some more of the like web work. And back then we were actually doing like just basic HTML. I don't even think CSS was a thing, not to date myself. But we were in Photoshop making web pages and then using tables to cut them, or the slice tool to cut them in the tables, and it would code it for you. And then you'd have to go in and fix the code. So I don't call myself a coder, but like that's how I forced myself to learn to start to code. And that was like a really great transition too. And another skill that helped me be more competitive, or at least more attractive to a job market.
Was the pay not something that was a concern at that point? Or was it just, I just need to get out of here? How did the money sort of play into taking that risk?
I think the money at that time was kind of, it was very incremental. But, you know, at that point, if you can make like just $2,000 more, it's like, this is making it, right? This is moving towards something. So I think between the call center, and then I worked at a small publishing company, and then I actually worked in I worked as a civil trial visual design person. And so you like take all the graphics they need for trials, and then you make them and you animate them. And so that was another little baby step. And then getting the agency job was shortly after that. And it, like, it was really incremental, just a couple $1,000s every one. But you know, that felt like progress. And yeah, so I don't know if that answers the question, but that's just how it was for me. It's just like, continue to find like what's next. And it's not necessarily a linear line, and it shouldn't be. You should like test things out and weep back and forth and figure out what's right.
Yeah. Yeah. We talked about this for a bit during our pre-call, just the fact that a lot of folks who are listening, to this podcast want to eventually get into big tech. But for you, for me, it wasn't an overnight out of college, you know, straight hiring process. You had an amazing run at the agency, but what were some of the reasons why you started looking outside of that? And then also the road to getting into big tech.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm always jealous of the people that can get those jobs out of school. Like, that. I don't really know how lucky they are, because it didn't work out that way for me. I was applying at Google, where I am today, since I lived in Florida, you know, like 10 years ago. But, you know, having being comfortable in my agency job, like I felt I was good at it. I was on every sales call. I feel like I was really a good manager. I was like good at all the different little hats you have to wear as an agency person. The problem is, as a passionate UXer, because UX was becoming more of a respected actual like phrase, even though the phrase has been around since the 80s, I never got to see the project through, right? Like you're building these beautiful projects, then you're trying to future-proof them, but you don't know what the future holds for them. And typically the future is like they run out of money at like a, you know, 3 month, 6 month contract, you hand off the project, and it's for the most part destroyed. I feel terrible saying that. But you know, like the client would either like go in and like change all the fonts to Comic Sans and like be like, why is it so ugly? It's like, God, design is a thing. I'm not just like a pixel pusher. Or I don't know. Just there wouldn't be like the level of expertise there that maybe needed to be had. And a lot of times people are doing startups and their first startup always fails. And it feels like we were doing it. And I love that. You know, I learned a lot. They learned a lot. And not all of the projects failed. Some of them got acquired and some of them are huge now, especially in the drone technology industry, which I love that I was a small part of that. At the same time, I wanted to do research. You know, I was doing kind of like small research in coffee shops, like, does this thing work for you? But we didn't have budget for that. And so research and actually iterating was a huge thing I wanted to do. So after, I think, 8 years at the agency being creative director, I think I oversaw, I don't remember how many people, it was probably like 7 or 8. I was like, I'm just going to take a leap and see what the universe has in store for me. And don't get me wrong, this agency took care of me. I went to quit when they moved me to Raleigh, and I went to quit. And I was in tears because I loved them. And they were like, no, 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 just tell us when we're opening our New York City office. And so they helped move me to New York. So it also had that kind of like connective tissue. But at the same time, really had to just take a leap and swing for the fences, which is scary. But so quit my job with nothing lined up in a New York City apartment I could barely afford. My partner and I took the ferry over to IKEA. You can take the boat from Manhattan. And we went and picked up a desk and I set it up. I was like, okay, universe, what she got for me? And fortunately, universe was not paying attention. She was like, girl, I'm busy. And so I was like applying for things and getting more incrementally depressed, as one does, like when you're applying to like hundreds of things every week and getting nothing back. And like, maybe I am not worth anything. Maybe I did make a mistake. Maybe I should go crawling back. Maybe I should move back home. Like, all these thoughts come into your mind, but you just got to keep grinding. I actually would write on my window, I don't remember what my motivational message was. It was something like, you got this today, or like something just to make me get out of bed. But yeah, and it was one of those things where I was like working out of a WeWork and I just posted when I was available on job boards. So getting little freelance jobs, which helped me. But then I got landed a larger role at a startup. And so I was like, oh, wow, this is actually making me more money than I made at the agency. And then I was like kicking myself. I was like, why didn't you do this sooner? Because I was scared. You know, I was like, people were telling me, and honestly, I hate it when people try to give you advice and they don't know nothing about tech. They know nothing about design. They don't live in New York City. So anyway, I shouldn't have listened to them. I'm going on and on, but, you know, taking that leap, I think was really, really huge. And once I landed that first startup job, I found I was able to use a lot of the skills that I learned as in the agency work, but I was finally able to start doing research and iterating on a product, as well as using my strategy skills. So that felt really satisfying. It was a good transition, even though the company had other issues, every company. But yeah, that was a great transition for me. And I'm so glad that I took that scary leap.
I love that you took the leap, because it is really scary as someone who is softly exploring what's beyond the golden handcuff safe setting. But I also really gravitate to why you took the leap, as in, it is very easy to become complacent in a role, but you had a very specific skill set that you wanted to improve on, the UXR research. And for that, having that specific goal sort of propelled you to get there. And I think it might be, you know, for many of us, either a goal of increasing salary, a goal of meeting better team, like, as important it is to understand your non-negotiables, also understanding what do you want in your next career move to improve that career satisfaction and life satisfaction bars. I think that's super important.
Yeah, I definitely agree. That's super important. And I also teach on the side and my students are like, where should I go work? Should I work at an agency or a startup or a big tech? And I'm like, all of them. Because you're not going to know what you want until you do it. So it's real easy for me to reflect on things because I worked for 3 large tech companies now. But like, I learned so much from every experience, and every experience gives me stories that I use either in coaching other people when I'm a manager, but especially in interviews, because like, they love hearing like challenges that you work through with challenging people, or and so I love having those stories to look back on. And it's actually like, you don't really think about how much you've accomplished in those challenging situations until you take index of your life. And it's like, oh, that's very cool. So, yeah, I lost sight of the question there, but I think it's really important to pay attention to what you think you want to build on, and it can be money. That's okay. I'm not going to poo-poo on money. Everybody loves that. But typically, at least in my experience, like the money comes, and I think the more risks you take, at least in my situation, granted, I've been lucky and fortunate in some ways, but taking the risks is the first thing that I did that actually helped propel me to every single next step that I had.
And your graph definitely shows that once you took that risk, it was a up trajectory. Was that intentional, or was that how did the upward escalation happen?
So after that agency, or sorry, after the startup job, is when I started applying at big tech a little bit more, because I felt like I had really solid stories that I could tell and great things to show in my portfolio. And so interviewed a lot, but finally landed this interview at Shutterstock, where they bring you into the Empire State Building. So I'm already like, if I don't get this job, this is still like really cool. I'm like secretly taking pictures. And so, you know, going through the normal interview process there, which is a whole podcast in and of itself, but was able to like showcase my story in a way that I think they liked, because I was able to show not only can I do like smaller jobs, get things done and be really efficient, work with engineers, but I showed another project that was like large and nebulous and messy and was able to like work through that. And they loved seeing that contrast. However, after the interview, I was like, I didn't get this. And they're walking me around, showing me the office. I was like, that's so mean that I didn't get the job. They're showing me the office. But no, like a few days later, Wes, who I'm still friends with, who actually works with me at Google now, was like, hey, you got the job. I'm like, no, that's awesome. And so with that kind of role, the pay was just like a little bit more, but I finally had like stock. I don't know what the GSUs are. What does that even mean? I was Googling things every day. But had access to a 401k again, which I didn't have for a while, as well as like I wasn't paying for healthcare. But I think the opportunities that Shutterstock gave me is, you know, I started out on the native app team. I love that team. I was slowly showing my skills and like earning credibility. And so they kept adding more and more things. I became a manager and a director really quickly there. And I think I was able to just like learn a lot, make a lot of mistakes, but also just help tell a story that helped push our products forward a little bit more. And I think showing that from a UX side in a company of that size is really important. And so it was through like learning storytelling skills, strategic skills. I also had excellent managers there with Wes and Maggie. So that really helped me get ready for the next phase, which is at Mongo, and the next phase that I'm at now, which is at Google. And I just think these things build on each other, and the more confidence you have, you build your vocabulary, you have more stories to tell. I think that just like it just starts to happen. I don't know any other way to say it except that.
Once the war wounds harden, it's definitely an arm of honor, a badge of honor that you can show off for sure.
I worked my ass off for it, right? And like some people do get out of school, and that's awesome. And I love working with those people and help provide those war stories for them to help them, which is great. But no, it didn't come easy for me. But at the same time, like I'm really happy to have not had an easy road. I think I showed a lot, and like it shows that to myself, next time I'm scared to take a risk, I have this backlog of like, girl, you've done this. Like, just do it again. If it doesn't work, turn around and stop it. You know, it's not a big deal. So that's kind of nice.
I want to piggyback off on something that you just mentioned. As much of a badass as you are building out in the UXR world, you also mentioned the importance of learning the soft skills.
Yeah.
What is it about communication and storytelling that you think is critical in your career trajectory?
Yeah. So, and quick correction, I'm actually not in UXR. I kind of do it on the side, but I'm mostly a UX designer. It also in teaching, like I teach the hard skills, right? Like we're showing you the process and we're showing you how to use Figma and all of that. But the biggest part of our job as UX designers is how to tell a story, how to sell something, how to make like the UX of understanding an idea even simpler. And that's where those soft skills come in. And so I do a lot of coaching, now, but how I got there was mostly through, you know, you read a lot of books, you later read a lot of Daniel Pink, I know people hate on like old Dale Carnegie, but they updated the book, How to Win Friends and Influence People. I swear by those techniques. learning people's names, learning their dog's names, learning their kid names, and like, it really helps them like you more, and suddenly your foot's in doors you otherwise wouldn't be in. And so there's that part of soft skills, learning how to be likable and personable, but also like a really great listener, repeating ideas back to them, or making sure you give people credit. Every presentation, I'm like, I got this, you know, so-and-so seeded this idea, but another part of it is the storytelling part. And I know there's all these like business clashes around storytelling, which I think might be useful if you have like something really specific you're planning for. But I feel like storytelling has to happen before any of that. Like, you need to learn some basic techniques. And so I study like Moth style storytelling, which is, if you've ever listened to NPR, like the Moth, yes, on the weekends. Yeah. And so you get a theme. You have 5 minutes. You are not allowed to have any notes. And you just have to get on stage and tell your story. And there's lots of techniques. Like, you can start with a hook. You can go backwards. But you can, like, make something funny and then make something sad, make something funny again. How do you keep an audience interested? How do you change your pace? How do you not say, like I just said? But there are many different ways to make yourself, like, come off as more interesting. But I think one of the biggest things that I try to coach and remind myself is how to be succinct, or how to cater to your audience. Like, you know, for this audience, I can be a little bit more verbose, try to stay on topic. But if you're giving a presentation at work, or if you're interviewing, like, keep the question in mind, you know, make it really interesting, maybe say something funny, wrap up your point, what did I learn? And then, you know, 3 minutes, you're out of the question. I think being succinct is something that is like really you have to learn. And sometimes it's hard culturally. I understand like this is an American thing, like go, go, go. But if there is a way to like cater your message and your story to your audience and figure out what is best for them, what do they want to know? What are they bored with? That's what storytelling did for me. And in the classes, you're able to tell your story and they're like, I really liked this detail, this detail, this detail. That detail about your grandmother didn't push the story along, so you can probably cut that. And so by practicing that over and over again, meanwhile, taking a 20-minute story and then slowly shaving it down, now you have 12 minutes, now you have 8 minutes, now you have 6 minutes, is a really great way to teach that. And I learned through mostly through Adam Wade at the Magnet Theater here in New York. They do classes online and in person. If you take it, tell him I sent you. I love Adam so much. He's taught me a lot. And I've also done a lot of stories on stage at the Moth as well. So there's a few that have been recorded. Not all of them are safe for work, but it really has taught me a lot about myself and how to teach, how to present better at work.
That is such a great advice. I am definitely going to look both of these up. Also, my respect for you has just gone up a few notches. The fact that you were on the Moth stage. That is amazing.
It's terrifying. Like, when they called my name, I think I said many expletives out loud. But after it's over, it's such a just a warm community. And you get a lot of friends that way. You learn a lot about yourself. And I think it's been, especially when you first move to New York City and you don't know how to make friends, that's a great way to start. It's a hard way because it's really nerve-wracking. And I think I was sweating and crying. But yeah, it's great.
I love it. I love it. I also really want to double down on the point that you made about catering the content to your audience and the importance of being concise. Yeah. Sometimes when I get nervous, I think I start to ramble on, and that does not serve you when you're presenting to leadership.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's where those skills really come in. I say to folks that I'm coaching or presenting with, I was like, we are going to practice out loud. And they're like, we don't need to. That's silly. I'm like, no, we need to, especially if I know there's somebody that's a little gross. I know that sounds terrible, but like, no, we have to practice out loud. I give them a run of show. You know, you have 3 minutes, like, or when with my students, I literally tell them, oh, I usually demo with my phone. I don't know where it is, but like, I'm like, put your phone on your monitor. Like, we're not in person. You can do that. Start the timer. And then if you're running long, you know to wrap it up. But don't tell the audience, like, no, I'm running long. No, you just keep going. But with leadership, too, especially if you can't memorize it, you still have slides, which is awesome. Just the Moth, you don't get any slides. So it's all in here. But I still use the same techniques. There's a technique called the box method, where you write out your whole story or maybe your whole script, every single line you want to say. Then you go back and you start to shorten it. Okay, what is the main idea here? And you just have like maybe 10 sentences. From there, you box around the words that are most important. Like Adam tells a story about his cat, and it's like, okay, rain, mittens. And then you only have 5 words to remember. And so anytime you lose your point in your script, you're like, what's the next word? Oh, I know what comes next. So I think that makes you a little bit better prepared too, because you know what beats you want to hit and you're not really improvising. Of course, improvising is a whole different skill. Magna offers classes around that too. But I think it's really important with leadership to practice your presentation, make sure you have your beats there. What are they there to learn? They don't want to know the ins and outs of like how you struggle with a certain engineer. Like they don't really want to know that unless it gets escalated. Yeah, what does the audience want to know? It's super important with leadership.
Interesting, as you were honing all of these skills, for quite a while, your life satisfaction curve was fairly flat, while your net worth and your career trajectory was on the ups.
Yeah.
What was happening then?
I think, you know, it's funny. I did this like once a year, and I was like, it's okay. I think, you know, month to month, things fluctuate a lot. You know, when I first got away from the startup, which was becoming a little bit toxic, it would have been really down. But then like the Shutterstock job put it way up. And then we were like back to the middle. I was like, I don't know what I'm doing. Like imposter syndrome, like whole thing. So I think it kind of looks neutral in that way. Of course, like landing that role in 2020, getting into Mongo and having a lot more money to play with helped a little bit as well. And like, oh, now I can afford to do other things. I can invest in things. I never could do that before. And so that takes life satisfaction in a different direction because it opens up doors you otherwise couldn't. You know, when I've been paid, fortunately, I've been paid decently my entire career, but like it was finally at a point, I was like, oh man, you could actually like go on a trip like every other month if you wanted to. Like you're actually talking to your investment advisor about what's the early stage you can retire. And I've never had those conversations before. It was like, no, you're not going to have enough money ever to retire is the joke, right? And I finally opened up a door for that. So I feel like that takes life satisfaction up when it feels like you have at least a couple less things to worry about. And, you know, instead of like worrying about your retirement, you're like, oh, you know, where's my next airplane going to take me, you know? So it's really works really hard to get here. I'm very privileged, but I did, you know, I feel like it's nice. And that's why the lines look the way they do, I think.
I love it. I am a huge proponent of the thought that money is not everything, but it is a great tool. We shouldn't necessarily be emotionally tied to it, but it does make life easier. And to your point, it just opens up more opportunities. So you were aggressive in terms of risk taking, and along all of those lines, you were taking salary negotiations and like jumping up your compensation as part of that. But once you came to Google, that was an interesting turn. Compensation wasn't the top priority here. How did that come about?
Yeah. So in looking at taking index on everything, I was very happy with the culture and the people at Mongo. The compensation was wonderful. They were very generous with our GSUs and like really cared about employee well-being. But that was the time when Google finally answered my call after 10 years. And they're like, hey, we finally want you. And I'm like, yeah. Okay. And, you know, I love Mongo. It's, you know, it's a database product. Like we're definitely helping apps and websites all over the world scale their business. And that's really cool. And like mostly like look at these apps, like they're all running on MongoDB. And that's cool. And that's good bragging rights. At the same time, I kind of wanted to work on a product that I felt like my mom would know. Which is maybe not fair, but also, you know, looking at all the different Google products, I was like, this would be cool. This might be something that I'll do for a little. Maybe it'll be awesome. Maybe it won't. I don't know. But like, I love these products. I've always wanted to be a part of it. Mm-hmm. My portfolio had like fake products I made for Google at some point because I was like, these ideas are too good to just like not post on the internet somewhere. So yeah, so they called and then they told me like what position it would be for and what the salary was. And it was like a few steps below where I was at Mago as a director. I was coming in essentially the equivalent of a senior designer. And the pay was back to where I was when I worked at Shutterstock. And I was like, okay, still fair compensation. But like once you had that like emotional safety of like, oh, here's my retirement age. And like, it was like, okay, you got to like go back, bootstrap a little bit better. And that was fine because like it's enjoyable to like, hey, I work at Google. That's cool. Then also the career satisfaction took a hit because when I first started, it wasn't what I expected at all. Mm-hmm. And I went through moments where I was like, what did I sign up for? And I was, you know, just emotionally not well because I just wasn't satisfied with how the work was going. I was like crying with my mentor. But eventually I was able to like earn enough credibility, like battle through some of the like things that were happening and turn that around. And now they're like throwing projects at me that, you know, are really challenging or really satisfying. I just got transferred to the YouTube team. So like, I think that showed like battling through those like cobwebs when I first started was really important in moving to the next stage. So I feel like we're back up. It's a little bit harder at Google to get promoted, which is another thing that was surprising to me. But I think people should consider that, right? Like when you work at a smaller tech company, they're more likely to advance you quickly, which is what I was used to. And I thought it would be the same at Google, but of course it's not. It's a huge company. So they have a lot of different other kinds of hoops that you have to go through, probably similar to Meta and elsewhere. But that's okay. That's just part of the process. And I think it was a good risk to take. But a lot of folks, when I first did this, they're like, I can't believe you're taking that much of a pay cut to go to Google. And I was like, well, this is about product passion, you know, and there's more than just money, and I think money will come back. And I, like I said, have that track record of taking a risk. So let's try again. So we're yet to see if it's like fully paid off, but a lot of days I'm like looking at the work I'm doing, like, holy crap, you are changing the way people are using the internet. And that's, you can't get that at most companies. Like, that's crazy. So I love that.
I really, really, really love how you're going about all of this in the point of, yes, I absolutely do believe you need to work to a certain salary level where, you know, it's livable. But yeah, at a certain point, once your career grows and your salary grows, I love the fact that you're really taking salary as one of the vectors, not the sole vector, and taking the risk to, man, your life satisfaction is hitting an all-time high. Love it. Love it.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, I've said many times, I'm very fortunate. I'm not going to like say, you know, I'm not going to brush that aside, but, you know, did put a lot of work into it. But, you know, I think too, life satisfaction, when I was actually thinking about it to reflect on this chart, if you would have asked me in December, it probably would have been lower because I was pretty grumpy about a few things. But, you know, I was taking index on something with my partner recently, and I was like, holy crap. I don't know if like something bad's about to happen because I had this catastrophic thing in my mind, but I'm like, things are going really well. That's really odd. Like, and we're planning all this stuff, and like, I don't know. Is this what like feeling comfortable feels like? Like,
yeah.
That's cool. So, yeah.
One common theme that we've seen throughout all of your trajectory has been taking risk, even though you weren't comfortable, even though the situation wasn't perfect. And that's sort of manifested in taking career risks, taking compensation hits, etc. Do you have an internal criteria for when to take risks?
The general criteria is if it scares me and excites me at the same time, you got to go for it. And I don't really have a playbook for how that goes because every decision's a little bit different. But I'll pivot from career examples and give you an example. Let's say, well, there's one moving to New York because everybody tells you like, oh, you're going to fail. Like, I made a whole video about that one. I love that one. But maybe a smaller one is like, I really didn't like my last name when I was growing up. And so in 2016, after thinking about it for 20 years, I was like, okay, I think I'm going to change my name. But like, what if my family gets mad? What if they all disown me because I'm like just choosing a random name because I just don't like the way my name sounds. But at the same time, I wanted to do speaking opportunities. I wanted to teach. I wanted to mentor. And anytime somebody introduced Aaron Cummings, I just didn't feel great about it. And a name is something that you should feel really proud of and feel awesome about and want to have it blasted on a stage on a microphone. And so that risk was something else too. It's like, do I risk this? Like, dude, is my family going to be mad? And so I interview them and I ask them, but it just also feels weird. What if people make fun of me? Like, you're just like, I had a list of five random names and I chose one. I went to the courthouse, spent $65, and I thought the judge was going to be like, why are you changing your name? But none of that happened. It was all much scarier to think about than to actually do. And now I don't even tell people I changed my name. It's been since 2016. And when people find out, they're like, I could never imagine you with that name. It's like, me neither, because like that was like a different person. And I'm not equating it to like a dead name kind of thing, but like I just didn't have a confidence as that person. But it changing my name, scary. But like Erin Essex would do that. So she did. And yeah. And so people ask where the name came from. I used to, at my agency job, it was on Delancey Street and I lived on Houston Street and I would walk down Essex Street every day. And so I'd look up and I was like, oh, that sounds cool. I'll add it to the list. But I was like, Erin, you can't name yourself after a street. My friends were like, you can name yourself after anything you want. So yeah, that's just another kind of like scary risk thing that I think was huge for me in getting confidence.
I love the mentality. Erin Essex would do that.
Yeah, exactly.
You made all of these changes and you mentioned this a few times now that you recorded your steps in various mediums. So you mentioned sharing a mock product for Google on the internet, also mentioned something about creating a video, etc. Is that also a form of creativity and sort of cookie crumbs that you've left?
I think they're all a little bit different, but when it comes to like sharing ideas through the videos or social, it's like, or even teaching, there's this whole like philosophy about leaving a mark on the world. And I think some people use that as like a legacy thing. And it's not to me, it's more, how can I help other people create their own legacy, right? If sharing my story about how moving from home is scary on YouTube helps people, and it did, I would get these like comments that would make me sob. That's cool. I helped someone. If it's sharing my name change story helps somebody, they're like, I've been thinking about that for a while. Maybe I'll do it. Cool. But also in teaching, and like when people land their first UX job after taking my course, not that it's guaranteed, like they put in the work, but when they do, I'm like, holy shit, that's like huge for you. You know, somebody that was working in healthcare and now they work in UX. So I feel like that's an amazing part of it. And so sharing those ideas or sharing learnings with others is not really coming from an ego kind of place. It's just, I wish somebody would have shared these things with me and I could have gotten to that point a little sooner.
I love on LinkedIn, you mentioned helping creators grow on YouTube. As someone who is fledgling on YouTube, any advice? How to grow fast?
God, yeah. Well, I just started the YouTube role, so I can't say too much about that. But we're looking at other opportunities to help creators, especially like medium-sized creators. And you know, I am too soon on this to have any advice there, especially because I'm like looking at it from an advertising lens as well. But I think what's great about YouTube and the creativity on YouTube as opposed to other mediums is that long format. You know, it is being able to throw it up on my television and watch all day, or I'm working and I'm watching Broadway review videos all day. And I think having a long format has a different opportunity for you as a creator, because you're able to show more of your personality. You're able to show more of your vulnerability. You're able to show like different sides of you. And not everybody's going to love that. But that's what makes it great. It's because like they latch on to parts of you. Like I'm working with a social media person now because I'm trying to launch this new UX thing on Instagram. And I was like, well, should I filter myself? Should I not say like shit? Should I just be a little bit more polished? She's like, no. That's what people love about you. People are not everybody's going to like it. But if you come in and be like, here's what I did. Here's why it didn't work. Here's why it's bullshit. And here's what you should do. Like, that's something people can respond to. And I love that, like, YouTube is a medium for that. Like, there's always going to be haters. I don't know what they're doing, but so sad for them. But YouTube is a medium where you can actually, like, really show your full self. But I think that's a really great opportunity as a creator, and people do respond to that. So didn't exactly answer your question, but maybe in 6 months when I have more YouTube experience under my belt, I can answer that a little bit more clearly.
Well, no, that was great in terms of be your authentic self, whether in career, yeah, or YouTube. Final question.
But always Google. I'm sorry, just one last thing. Always Google things, because a lot of people use phrases, and I'm like, you shouldn't be using that phrase. So I'm like paranoid about it. Like, let me Google this phrase before. Like somebody was using broken window policy as like a way to police UX recently. I was like, oh no, you can't say that. Which, I mean, in New York, that's a thing. Or I don't even say the phrase rule of thumb. And I know that this has been debunked, but even that has some history that's debated. So anyway, I don't know why I'm thinking about that right now, but I thought that was important to share.
Interesting. I didn't know about the rule of thumb one. I will definitely...
It's been debunked, but even though a lot of people still believe that the thing is true, but... Yeah, anyway, always Google it and just make sure you know where your phrases are coming from, because sometimes they can be racist or misogynistic and you don't even know.
Very fair, very fair. Final question. You have literally been the history of UX at this point. How has that changed, and what still excites you about UX design?
I think what's great now as opposed to when I was starting is like UX is, people know what it is. But more importantly, people respect it. I feel like we have had to scramble to get our foot in the door, to be in the room, to be seen as strategists, and as opposed to just pixel pushers, or you just make the box, it's pretty, you just change the fonts. And there's nothing wrong with that, but that is not what we do. We are so much more comprehension than that. And some, don't get me wrong, companies are still not UX mature, maybe still think that way. But you have to advocate for yourself, get yourself in the room, show the strategy, show that, you know, you are more than that. But I love that we're finally at a place where you don't really have to do that as much. You know, in places like Google or Mongo or Shutterstock, like UX, they knew it was like, if we don't have a UX designer on this, this is not going to turn out well. And we know that because we've made this mistake too many times. So I feel like it's awesome that we're finally in a place where we are, you know, respect it. It's that three-legged stool. It's the product, the engineer, and the UX designer all working together. And so I think that's an excellent opportunity for people starting to break into the space now and get their footing. You know, people like me have like fought the way for you. Like now just like take the torch and keep going, because there's so many more cool ideas out there, especially with all the AI stuff coming. There's still like VR and voice stuff that needs to be designed. And there's also like UX for spaces, right? Or like products, like Doug Dietz, I think he worked with GE or IBM, did a bunch of like rework on hospital equipment that needs a UX designer too. So so I just love that there is this more like design thinking approach to everything right now. And although that's a little bit eye rolling and hand waving at certain applications, for the most part, it's awesome. And it's really badass that we've gotten to a point where we don't really have to keep fighting and advocating for ourselves, and we're invited. So it's pretty cool. And that's like a neat change that I've seen.
I absolutely agree. True to its name of user experience, it be sort of the industry becoming more human centric and just putting the experience at the center of it all. I think it's a step in the right direction.
Yeah, definitely agree.
If you sort of look at your work week or month, what would you say is I don't want to say typical, but a way that you break down your work attention span?
Ooh, in a typical week?
Or month, or a workflow, whatever that cycle might be.
I used to keep like little notebooks with outlines in them forever, and just like write out everything that had to be done and like the satisfaction of crossing something out. I am now graduated, thank you to Kat Smalls for recommending this, but doing that on an iPad, and that way this is in Google Keep. And if I leave my notebook, my iPad at home, it's always there. And so this has been huge in helping me organize and still having the satisfaction of writing, because things stick in your brain better if you write them down. So anyway, that's part of it. But thinking about in a typical week, like I'm doing a lot of strategy work recently, so I had to do some quick UXR work. So I'm working closely with a research person. So that's maybe was like 2 to 5% I'm doing a lot of strategy work on another project. So I'm writing strategy documents from a UX perspective, working closely with a product person. That probably took, I don't know, a solid like 15 to 20% recently. We've been doing a lot of design thinking around that. So it's finally nice to bring it into a paper where we can write a perspective and hopefully build a strategy around that. On the other project, like I am getting into Figma. I am an IC, I'm not a manager at Google. So I am doing a lot of IC work. I'm getting into Figma, figuring out this, all these screens we need for a framework across an entire department. So that's taking up the bulk of my time and meetings around. Oh, I should break up meetings into its own thing. Maybe the Figma work is, I'm not going to be accurate in my percentages, but I feel like the Figma work is probably a solid 30, and then the meetings take up maybe the rest. Because we are doing like really complex work, right? And so the Figma is important, but I'm pretty fast at Figma. You got to learn your shortcuts, y'all. But also know, like, same as storytelling, like, who's your audience and how much work do you need to get into in Figma? Sometimes you can get the point across without hundreds of screens. But the meetings are important. You got to drive the strategy along. You have to build relationships. You have to get one-on-ones with people that if you bring them into a group setting, maybe they will derail the meeting somehow. So I'm like pulling to the side, making sure we get aligned before I pull them into a big meeting. Takes a lot of time, but like that's how I've gotten noticed. So I feel like the meetings are a thorn in every designer's side, but I think for somebody like me that really cares about strategy and driving things forward and making really cool things on the internet, sometimes you gotta do the meetings.
Is the meeting, you mentioned alignment, but mostly with your XFNs, or are you also doing meetings with the leadership as well?
Mostly XFNs. Or soon to be exit, like right now I'm transitioning, so it's onboarding. Leadership meetings, we have office hours for, but it's at least at Google, it's not as frequent as it was at smaller companies like Mongo and Shutterstock, where we met with them more regularly. So with high leadership, it's probably maybe an hour a month. It's not my manager's doing a lot of that work. I'm at the IC level, we don't really talk to leadership that much directly, but it's just the nature of how we're broken down. Yeah,
for sure. So mostly working on alignment and strategic driving strategy.
Yeah. No, which is great for me because I love that. Like I tell my manager, it's like, you have a big hairy problem that nobody wants to touch. Give me that. I love that. And other designers don't like that. Other designers' charts won't look like this because they just want to like do their UX work and not get involved in this stuff. And me, I'm like, once I shipped my giant boulder, I don't know if you're familiar with the like sand, rocks, and boulders when it comes to size projects. Like sand you need, keep things moving. Rocks are important, but a little bit larger. And boulders are like, holy crap, we've been putting this off for a long time. We got to get it done. After I shipped my first boulder at Mongo, I was like, this is cool. Did it suck for a little while? Yeah. Was it stressful? Yeah. But like, holy crap. You ship something enormous. And so now I'm kind of addicted to boulder size projects.
That's probably the reason why Google wanted you and why you've been so successful. The fact that you're willing to get your hands dirty.
I hope so.
Yeah. There was a quote from President Obama that said something along the lines of, don't just tell me why things don't work. Be the one that says, I'll figure this out and you'll succeed. Yeah, Aaron Essex would do that.
Aaron Essex should do that. Don't tell me how to fix it. Show me. You know, I love that.
This was fantastic. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you so much for the time and the medium, and definitely hoping it's helpful to your audience. And it was fun to relive some of that and try not to cry. So I didn't.
Fantastic. We live, we learn, we survive, and we celebrate. Thank you.
All right, thank you.